Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Jack Farley. It is Wednesday, June 30th. I'm joined by Real Vision's Samuel Burke and Jared Dillion, publisher of the Daily Dirt Nap. Today was the third day in a row where U.S. Treasury yields fell with the 10-year below 1.44. Does that mean that the market is getting less worried about inflation? Samuel.
Well, Jack, you know, we've been talking about the Delta variant for the past couple of days here on the Daily Briefing. Now we're starting to see some of that spill over into the United States, local governments in some places urging people to mask up. I'm curious to get Jared's take on how or even whether he's factoring that into his bigger picture view of the markets, Jack.
And new numbers show that private employment in the U.S. is recovering faster than expected, particularly in the recovering leisure and hospitality sector. I know we'll be talking about labor inflation later, Samuel.
And I want to flip from inflation to possible deflationary winds. You know, we talked about that earlier in the week with our guest, Darius Dale. Well, lumber was one of the signs that he pointed to when it came to deflation. And lumber continues to go down, Jack, for the month, down 40%. So inflation and deflation right here on the Daily Briefing.
Yeah. So now I want to welcome our guest, Jared Dillion. So Jared, the last time we spoke, I believe, you were about to head out for vacation and things were really looking very, very good for the inflation trade. ExxonMobil was at $65. Tesla was on its back foot. Suddenly, you know, you go on vacation and the old saying of, oh, you go on vacation and then everything goes wrong. You go on vacation to Greece and suddenly there's the FOMC dot plot and oil and energy and the banks are getting smacked around. And ARK is now above, ARKK is now above $130. So what happened when you went to Greece?
Well, what happened is we had the FOMC meeting, like you said, and they moved the dots up. I mean, look, like I'm not surprised that we move forward expectations of a rate hike. And I think we talked about this at some point, but all the Fed speakers that were coming out, they were talking about tapering. They were talking about, you know, Kaplan in particular in Dallas. So if you were listening to the Fed, you know, what they did didn't come as a surprise. What surprised me was that everybody was surprised. That's what surprised me. And it had that big of an impact on the markets, especially the bond market. You had this, you know, atrocious flattening of the yield curve. And by the way, I don't know if you've seen a chart of twos, tens, but that was an indication to me that the steepening trade was very, very crowded, which I sort of didn't realize. But the flattening yield curve is the biggest threat to the inflation trade. Now, I was on Twitter today, and there's a guy named Will Slaughter. He's at Milwaukee Bonds, and he's got like 7,000 followers. He needs to have more followers. He's a very smart guy. He's a bond market guy. And what he was talking about was times in history in which the yield curve inverted, okay? So back in 2007, it inverted with tens at 4.5%. Back in 2017, it inverted with tens at 3%. He thinks that the yield curve is going to invert with tens at 1.5%. And in order for that to happen, short-term rates need to come up a lot. So, you know, we have a payroll number, I believe, on Friday. And there's all kinds of danger around this payroll number. You know, you would think that a strong payroll number, like if we got 1 million jobs on Friday, like that would be good for the inflation trade. But what that's going to do is it's going to bring rate hike expectations even more forward. 2-year yields are going to go up. The curve is going to flatten even more and you'll get more of this deflation trade. So, you know, before I left for Greece, I put on a hedge. I bought some S&P puts. It was a terrible hedge. because the S&P didn't really go down, but my inflation trade went down. And that brings up sort of a larger idea that the stock market right now, there's a lot of dispersion. Okay, so it's a great stock picking environment. You have stocks going all different directions. Sometimes you have periods of correlation where stocks are moving together. And sometimes, like now, you have periods of dispersion. And I had a hedge on, and it was a completely useless hedge. So if you're thinking about hedging against this sort of thing, you can't just buy index puts, S&P, NASDAQ, Dow. You have to tailor the hedge to your individual portfolio.
Jared, you mentioned dispersion. That makes me think of a tweet from Sentiment Trader who noted something a lot of technicians are seeing in the market, which is that the S&P 500 continues to make all-time highs, and yet the percentage of stocks within the S&P 500 that are trading above their 50-day moving averages is actually below 50%, so less than half. Is that what you meant by dispersion, and what does that mean to you? What does it signal?
It's not really what I meant by dispersion. I mean, that's really an indication of breadth. Breadth and dispersion are two different things. But but those numbers on breadth are, I mean, that's historically been a very good indication. You know, the sentiment trader guys, Jason, they have all kinds of great technical data, sentiment data on the stock market. And for the past year and a half, it hasn't been very useful. You know, I mean, they've had a bunch of indicators all the way up, and I think they're kind of frustrated. And they threw this out, and they're like, this always works, but maybe not this time because this is a different market. And, one of the things I've said is that, the bull market will end when the Fed withdraws liquidity, and they haven't withdrawn liquidity yet. All they've done is talk. Okay, that's all they've done. It's just jawboning, but they haven't tapered asset purchases. They haven't hiked rates. I think when they do start to taper, I think that's when you see some flattening in the yield curve, and that's when the market starts to run into trouble.
Jared, I wanted to circle back to bonds for a bit and the bigger talk about inflation, because you actually had a quite profound newsletter that you put out this morning, really talking about how so much of what we see, even in financial markets, is through a political lens, particularly in the United States. And you said one thing that stood out to me in the newsletter: Twitter liberals out there who are tweeting that interest rates going down must mean that there is no inflation. I wonder if you can just expand on that. We don't want to get into the whole Democrat-Republican thing. There are plenty of cable news outlets where people can have those conversations. But you're really talking about how this affects people's framing of the market. And you put out a chart that I was trying to decipher and make sense of. So talk a little bit about what you said in the newsletter, and maybe we can go over that chart, because I'm rather intrigued.
Yeah, so people argue about finance all day on Twitter, okay? But at its core, all these financial arguments are political arguments, because conservative people believe all the same things and liberals believe all the same things. I have the chart up in front of me. So liberals generally buy growth stocks and conservatives buy value stocks. Liberals believe in deflation and conservatives believe in inflation. Liberals think interest rates are going down and conservatives think interest rates are going up. There's this schooling effect where people sort of all believe the same things. So one of the things that I was noticing, I mean, we've had this retracement in rates of about 40 basis points, and people on the left side of the political spectrum, which I don't want to name names and get into trouble or anything, but they don't believe that we are in an inflationary environment, the 5% CPI notwithstanding. And they think that rates backing up 40 basis points is an indication of deflation. I actually don't think so. And naturally, one of the reasons I don't think so is because I'm on the other side of the political spectrum. I think we have inflation. I think it's really more of an indication of flows and positioning, especially out of Asia, this move that we've had in rates. I think that explains most of it. So I don't think that, 10's going from 1.8 to 1.4 doesn't mean that this inflationary impulse suddenly goes away.
And why do you think that the liberal mindset or the conservative mindset would respectively go toward deflation or inflation? I hadn't perceived that in the markets at all, that more liberals were seeing deflation and conservatives inflation. So what do you think is that mindset?
I think I'm going to try to deconstruct this a little bit. I mean, I'll just talk about it from my own standpoint. I'm not going to, explain anybody else's point of view. Mm-hmm. I think that if you have a belief that we're in an inflationary environment, then you believe in the impotence of the central bank to control inflation. Okay. And if you're on the other side, if you believe that the Fed actually has the power to control inflation, and that really has to do with faith in government institutions. And that's really where the political nexus is in this trade. So, I mean, there was a bunch of other stuff in the list. There was, you know, ESG and buybacks and dividends and, you know, fiat currencies versus Bitcoin and gold. But, you know, if you look at the people who argue on Twitter all the time, they're all on either side of the fence on all these issues. So every financial argument is also a political argument. We just don't realize it.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Jared, I want to know, why is active management, do you associate with conservatives, whereas indexing and low-fee passive investing is something you associate with conservatives?
That's a very easy one to explain because, you know, if you're liberal, you tend to believe in efficient market theory. You believe that people can't beat the market, okay? And it comes down to market efficiency. And if you're conservative, you generally don't believe in market efficiency. You believe that the market can be beaten. So we did have a period of about 10 years where, you know, people were piling into index funds. Vanguard got $5.5 trillion in assets. And now in the last 6 to 12 months, we've had this period of time where active management is actually outperforming. More people are beating the index and people aren't going into index funds anymore. They have Robinhood accounts and they're trading.
I want to talk about something else that could have a political angle, though I would prefer that it didn't, and that's the Delta variant. You know, we talked the past couple of days about the effect it had on the European travel industry. So I'm curious, with something like this, there are a lot of people in the Real Vision audience who see the alarmist headlines in the media. Certainly, we know that media does very well. When you're getting people to click, you're getting people to watch, and certainly coronavirus is something that draws them in. But when you actually see governments start to change policies as a result of the Delta variant, the way we've seen in Europe, now some small, I don't want to overspeak what's going on in the U.S., but you see L.A. putting in, you know, encouraging people to use masks again. I'm curious, how do you factor that in to your view of the market then, Jared?
Well, I think a good analog here is terrorism back in the 2000s. So, you know, 9/11 had an enormous impact on the market. The stock market was down about 20%. And then there were smaller terrorist attacks in the 2000s after that. There was the one in Spain. There was the one in London. And after each terrorist attack, the market impact got smaller and smaller. And now we don't really think about terrorism today. So, you know, if the Delta variant were to have an impact, it would be smaller than the original impact. And successively over time, this is just going to recede from our consciousness. And I'm not at this point, it's very hard to position for something like this. Like if you thought that the Delta variant was a factor and you wanted the short stocks, I mean, that could be a very painful trade because this sort of thing doesn't really matter until it matters. Like everybody knows the Delta variant is out there, but at some point, if it does matter, we'll reach a tipping point and it will be in the public consciousness and then it will matter to the markets. But until then, nobody cares. And for me, it's not really a factor. You can't really predict these things. You can only react to them.
Yeah, the Jared, what you said makes me think about that. What it really hinges on is can fully vaccinated people be affected by this? Not what can one or two, but can a substantial percentage of them can? Because the narrative that has been out there is if you're fully vaccinated, you can do whatever you want. You can go to concerts, you can go to the beach, you can go to, you know, indoor events like you and I did when we went to your party last Friday, which was incredible. But, you know, your freedom is not restricted at all. This is the first time, at least in the U.S. for a while, that what we seen in L.A. was that they said, hey, even if you are fully vaccinated, we still recommend that you wear masks. That is, I guess, a shift that, if not a you know, a real physical shift, that is at least a tonal one.
Yeah, I think it comes down to deaths and hospitalizations. I mean, you know, if you get sick with the Delta variant, but it's mild and there really aren't any consequences, then, you know, theoretically, there wouldn't be any reason to change policy on that. But when you start talking about people being hospitalized or people dying from it while they're vaccinated, then yes, that would have an enormous impact. I haven't studied it a lot, so I can't really speak to that, but that should be the criteria.
Well, I was just mentioning, I'll just say it again, you know, we have the Delta variant spreading where I am, but hospitalizations, death, very, very low. So hopefully those are lagging indicators that stay just the way that they are.
Jared, I want to ask you, let's go back to bonds. Are you viewing bonds as a potential hedge to your value investments, which are very you know, negatively correlated with rates?
I've thought about it. I think it's a little bit too late. That's the problem. You know, and if the back end rallies even more, I don't think it's going to rally more than 10 or 20 basis points. So to initiate a hedge here, you know, to hedge the inflation portfolio with a long bond position, I think it's just too late, and I'll just chop myself to bits. And I think it's a bad idea.
All right. We have a question from Tom. Says, Jared, do you see any signs of market exhaustion, and how would you protect yourself in a correction?
I guess the only sign of market exhaustion that I could really verbalize is, I mean, the chart looks tired. You know, when I look at the chart of the S&P 500, it looks very tired. We have very low volatility. We're moving 20-30 basis points a day. The last 2 days, we've traded in a 10-point range in the S&P. I kind of struggle to come up with a catalyst that would get the S&P another 5 to 10% higher. I'm having a tough time thinking of that. Doesn't mean I'm bearish, but the chart looks tired.
Yeah, just to that point, the NASDAQ, the Q's down 16 basis points today, and the S&P up 13 basis points. So not a whole lot of movement on the surface. Samuel?
Yeah, well, the other topic that I really wanted to get Jared's thoughts on were these new employment numbers that we had out. Private sector jobs actually beat expectations, 692,000 jobs added with expectations of 600,000, I believe. So we're just getting back into that inflation discussion again. So I'm wondering where you think that fits in when you talk about labor inflation. I think of all the inflation verticals out there, that one seems to be the most potent. So how does that factor into your thinking as you look forward?
Well, you know, just anecdotally, you know, here in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, this is, you know, it's basically a hospitality industry here. It's hotels and restaurants. And the labor shortages here were very acute. Like, it was bad. You know, you'd go into a restaurant and they'd have one server and one cook, and they could serve a couple of tables, and it was a bad situation for a while. The labor shortage seems to be have abated. You know, restaurants are full at this point. The hotels are full. I think people have gone back to work. I think that's reflected in the private payroll numbers. So I do think that I'm not really in the game of predicting economic data. And I think even if you knew the economic data in advance, I don't think you can make money off of it. But I do think we're going to have a pretty strong payroll number on Friday.
Jared, a key input to your thesis about wage inflation was the benefits that unemployed people could get. Does the fact that these benefits are rolling over in many states, and in some states have already rolled over, I'm talking about state unemployment insurance. Does that make you less confident in your inflationary call, particularly when it comes to labor inflation?
I don't really understand. Can you explain that?
Oh, sorry. Well, so I'm just seeing that there are early end dates for enhanced jobless benefits like Alaska, Ohio, Mississippi, Missouri. I believe in South Carolina. Four days ago, the enhanced job benefits are over. Do you think that will transfer to a new regime where there's, you know, less of an incentive for people to stay home?
Yeah, for sure.
People going to go back to work?
You know, the states that have done this represent a pretty small percentage of the population, but I think it's kind of a sneak preview of what's going to happen when the benefits ultimately expire. You know, you're going to see the unemployment rate drop pretty dramatically. I mean, we're at 5.8 right now. We could be at 5.5, 5.6 on Friday. But once these benefits expire, you'll see unemployment go back to the four handle pretty quickly.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, though, given your views on inflation. And if that happens, then shouldn't that drive keep wages from inflating too much?
No, I don't think it'll put a cap on wages at all. I think that now that wages have risen, they're not going to come back down. Wages are very sticky. So, you know, the wages that have been set during the pandemic are not going down. And they might go down in some places here and there, but by and large, they're not going down.
Jared, I want to ask you about the commodity trade. Commodities have been totally benefited. They've been swept up in this reflationary wave over the past, let's say, 9 months. Lumber, copper, oil, they were all simply exploded higher. But over the past month and a half, lumber has fallen, copper has fallen. You've seen that these commodities have rolled over, and oil is kind of the last man standing, with Brent somewhere, I don't know, $74. Do you think that we could see some weakness to follow, or do you think that oil will continue to be the last man standing?
No, I don't think so. I don't think people should really look at lumber as an indicator. I think it's a very poor indicator. What happened to lumber that last run up was pure speculation. The 40% up, 40% down, I think that's just sort of an anomaly. I think it's speculation. A lot of people are looking at that lumber chart and they're saying, oh, we're having deflation. It's just a special case. Like, I don't think you can look at number. When I look at charts of the ags, especially corn, I think they're starting to look pretty good. I think they're starting to turn. Oil, like you said, is a special case, and I think the supply-demand dynamics for oil are going to be good for a really long time. So, you know, ex lumber, I think I'm still bullish on commodities. It hasn't changed my thesis at all.
Yeah, I think I saw corn was up something like 7% today on news from the Department of Agriculture that something about plantings. Sorry, Samuel, were you going to say something?
No. We've got another question coming in. I don't want to divert from this topic and totally go back to Delta variant. But Larry's asking you, Jared, don't you think that the Delta variant is one of many stories we will likely see over the next few years, even if forced into another lockdown in the U.S.? Don't you think fiscal and monetary policy will remain unchanged and therefore continue to boost asset prices?
That's a good question. It's a matter of the path that we take to get there. Because, pardon my language, but I don't think the Fed has the balls to do this. I really don't. You know, if they were at 120,
you think they're so afraid if they change course that they'll spook everybody?
In not so many words, you know, we're at 120 billion a month in asset purchases. If they taper it to 90, they taper it to 60, they taper it to 30, then the market gags, right? Then stocks are down 10, 15%. The VIX goes up to 35 and they'll stop. They'll stop because, you know, this Fed, unlike the Volcker Fed or the Greenspan Fed, I mean, they're afraid of the market. So, you know, I think we'll head down this path of tightening, but ultimately, I don't think we're going to go all the way.
Jared, I think one aspect of the question was that if the Delta variant is really, really bad and there are variants, will fiscal and monetary policy continue to, you know, be as dominant as they have over the past year? And my answer is perhaps Yes. And if so, Jared, my question for you is, what's the playbook? Is it what the same thing that you would have done if you could look back in the future? Whereas when we go into lockdown, you buy Zoom, you buy the Fangs. And then once you get out of lockdown, you buy ExxonMobil and you buy the banks. Is that the playbook? How are you thinking about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not thinking about it. I mean, this is all hypothetical. Right. I mean, sure. Like if we had a lockdown because of the Delta variant, buy Zoom. Yeah, absolutely. I'm very skeptical.
Yeah, I think we're still a long way away from that. Even in the UK, for instance, we've been talking about they're moving ahead with their July 19th full and final unlocking, even with the spread of the Delta variant. But yeah, it's a good question. The other thing that I was thinking about when you were saying that the Fed doesn't have the cojones, as we might say in Spanish, to do that. I mean, do you think the ECB has more cojones to do that? Because you look, they've indicated that they're not going to taper, that they don't think we're out of the crisis over here.
Yeah, I saw some comments from Lagarde. You know, it's I don't think they have any intention of tightening monetary policy at all. I mean, I was just in Europe. You know, I was just in Greece, and Greece bond yields just went below zero. You know, it's pretty nuts. The amazing thing is that, you know, Europe has become a little bit like Japan. And I think if they did tighten, I actually think it would be beneficial for equity prices, including the banks. And I actually bought the European bank ETF a couple of weeks ago, and I'm immediately regretting it because I saw those comments out of Lagarde, and I just don't know when they're going to get off of zero. So,
Jared, I want to ask you a question, which I saw something in your newsletter, the Daily Dirt Nap today, that really piqued my interest. And it sounded you were proposing a trade that you were going to go in on of actually shorting AMC via calls, so selling naked calls on AMC. Obviously, this has been a widowmaker trade, but you think that you can emerge victorious from this trade. Tell us why.
Well, I mean, this is what I call a fun trade. Okay. It's not a strategic trade. It doesn't really fit into the portfolio, you know, but I'm looking at AMC options. They're 200 vol. You know, the stock is at $55. You can sell the August calls for like 11 or 12 bucks. I mean, I sold a three lot. Okay. It's not a consequential trade at all. Having said that, you know, AMC like is probably worth zero. And if you look at the fundamentals of the movie business, like they're terrible. I mean, I'm talking about like ex-pandemic. Okay. Just take the pandemic out. People are staying at home. They're watching streaming. The content that the movie theaters are putting out is terrible. They rely on a couple of big tentpole movies. It's a terrible business, you know, and I actually think 5 or 10 years from now, you'll probably have half as many movie theaters in the U.S. So I don't even think that AMC is going to survive. Now, my trade is very short term. It's a month. You know, it's just a speculative trade. But, you know, I'm pretty comfortable with it.
Yeah, it's an interesting trade for sure. And also tell us about you are doubling down on buying puts on MSTR. Of course, that's MicroStrategy, the company that owns a lot of Bitcoin and now is essentially a proxy for Bitcoin. Tell us about that.
Do you really want to know?
Of course. Yeah. I don't ask questions when I don't want to know the answer.
So that's also a small trade. That's also a fun trade. I bought some December puts of MicroStrategy. It's December. And, you know, I think Bitcoin's in a bear market. If you look at a chart of Bitcoin, it's perfectly symmetrical. It's the biggest head and shoulders top of all time. After the head and shoulders comes the knees and toes. Okay. So I think, you know, I really do believe that Bitcoin's going to go back down to about 10,000 in the next 6 months. At a minimum, you know, Saylor's average price is 26,000. He's going to be tested. You know, the largest leverage player in any market is always tested. So, you know, I'm looking forward to when that happens. And, you know, there's the stock could get cut in half very, very quickly if that happens.
I'm just curious, what are the fundamentals driving your thinking on Bitcoin then? At going down to that level?
Well, there are no fundamentals in Bitcoin.
No
fundamentals down.
Yeah, your fundamental thinking. I mean, what are the factors that are putting it there for you? I mean, is it sentiment? Is it what's pushing you there?
It's really technicals. You know, the chart is broken. It's a bear market. It's down 50%. And actually, if you want to talk about fundamentals, you know, for sure, there's going to be a lot of regulation that's coming. And the, you know, the Bitcoin people are like, you know, bring it on. Like, you know, the regulation is going to be great. It's going to be good for Bitcoin. I don't necessarily think so. I actually saw there was a guy, I guess there's a Bitcoin committee in the Senate or the House. I just kind of breezed by this tweet, so I didn't really see. But he's talking about how there should be an ability to reverse transactions on blockchain. I mean, the people in charge of regulating this are totally incompetent. They're going to screw it up, and it's not going to be good for Bitcoin at all.
It reminds me of when Congress was trying to regulate the social media companies, which they're still trying to do. And a senator actually asked Mark Zuckerberg, "How do you make money missing the ads on the?"
I think Mark
network.
Was ever said, "A senator, we sell ads."
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Jared, thank you so much for joining us. Samuel, thank you as well. And thank you to everyone watching. Oh, quickly, Jared. So over the weekend, you DJed a very amazing party that's actually very close to the Real Vision office. I understand that you are putting another party on the docket during the fall. Tell us about that.
Yeah, November 12th, Friday, November 12th. It's going to be at the same place. It's a great space, as you know. I only have good people that I'm friends with. It's lots and lots. There's no buttheads there. It's a bunch of nice people. So, yeah, that party was awesome. Hopefully we can share some pics the next time. So
yeah, definitely. Let's do it. By the way, we have a final question, which, is from Ash Bennington, but my colleague, says not 100% sure that this is Ash. But from someone named Ash Bennington, Jared, why sell calls on AMC but buy puts on MSTR? Can you unpack why you're open to taking unlimited upside losses on one but not the other?
So not to get too technical, the AMC calls are more expensive than the MicroStrategy puts. So you want to sell options that are expensive and you want to buy options that are cheap. The MicroStrategy puts are not cheap. But in terms of implied volatility, they're cheaper than the AMC calls. So that's kind of the rationale for that. I don't want to be short calls on Bitcoin. Let's put it that way. So
yeah, that's a great way to put it. We do have something. We are going to, on Friday, there is an interview with a credit default swap trader named David Menaret. I did the interview and I learned a fantastic amount about credit default swaps. Not something you hear about every day. Of course, they were at the epicenter of the 2008 Great Financial Crisis. But David is exploring, you know, what if credit risk is underpriced? And I can get, you know, if the credit default swap market is basically priced as if the VIX were at 5 or 6. So with that, let's take a quick look at a clip that is going to be airing on Friday.
If I look at credit today, I think the markets are not pricing any kind of unknown unknowns. Markets are pricing absolute perfection for investment grade bonds, for high yield bonds, for leverage loans, for CLOs, for the entire ecosystem. And there are many attractive ways to take the other side of that bet, to think that maybe something bad will happen. May not be as bad as COVID. We hope not. But there are many ways to express a view throughout the credit default swap market, which is extremely cheap right now in terms of protection.
That airs on Friday on realvision.com on the essential tier. Jared, Samuel, thank you so much for joining us. And thank you to everyone at home who is watching.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.